Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my interview with Mark Steines. Part one, last week, we talked about what it's like to host the Rose Parade. Mark Steines, for 17 years, was with Entertainment Tonight. He was also one of the hosts of Home and Family on the Hallmark Channel for 6 years. And in this episode, we talk a lot about his career and how it was launched by being mistaken for Tom Cruise. Now, that's happened to me. It's probably happened to you as well. Anyway, some interesting things about his career. It's a unique career in broadcast journalism. Also, interviewing celebrities. A lot of good dish. That's this week, part two, with Mark Steines, this week on Hollywood and Levine. All right, let's start at the beginning now. How did you get into TV journalism?
You know, this is a really, how did I get into it? So I guess you'd have to go back to, I've always was interested in the photography component of it. And when I went to college, I couldn't find the college, any of the colleges that were recruiting me to play football didn't really have a broadcast, you know, or have a photography program. So I ended up, going to Northern Iowa, full ride scholarship, thought I was going to play pro football. And while I was there, I studied photography, but I blew through the courses pretty quickly. And just as I finished that, I was going to go, well, at least I'll take maybe the, you know, the 16 millimeter film class. And they did away with it, but they brought in videotape. That was probably, I would say, the beginning of my interest in doing, I won't say journalism so much, but more like television production. Because I really started off behind the scenes. I didn't have any intention of being in front of a camera. So when I ended up pursuing, you know, this particular part in communications, it led to an internship at the local TV station. And it's really interesting when you find something that really, really comes to you naturally. My grades soared. I was on full ride scholarship. I was getting an academic scholarship. I was making money going to college because there was the funds were there. So I ended up working at the local TV station. And because of that sort of infectious and supportive environment that I was around, people there were like, no, you need to get in front of the camera. I'm like, no, no. And they would, you know, push me to do it. And eventually I started going down that road. But then the real twist in all this is I couldn't find it. You know, I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, then I might as well do it. So I made tapes and I sent them out. And I was getting rejection letters, one right after the other. Couldn't get my foot in the door. It was either, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? You have to have experience before we'll hire you. But we can't get, you can't get experience unless someone hires you. So you're stuck.
Right. Catch 22.
So, yeah. Yep. So in 1988, Republican National Convention in New Orleans, I happened to go down. I was a cameraman, and we had Black Hawk Broadcasting Company had, I think, three affiliates that were there, and I was going to do the live shots for the other smaller markets, along with our main anchor, Ron Steele, who went. And we went down to New Orleans, and one thing led to another, and there was a gentleman by the name of Larry Perrette, who I still to this day adore. He... without getting into all the like, well, you know, all the stuff, but we met and he was like, oh, you look like Tom Cruise. And I'm like, oh, I've heard this since The Outsiders came out in high school.
A lot taller than Tom Cruise.
Yeah. So he started using that to get us into places because you couldn't get in anywhere because it was just so packed on the French Quarter.
So he would say, I got Tom Cruise over here.
Exactly. Exactly. And we started going into all these places. And now keep in mind, we would do live shots and then I'd have all these guys wearing suits and ties still with earpieces, you know, from doing live shots, walking around with us. They look like either agents or bodyguards or security detail or whatever. And we would go out. Well, long story short, Entertainment Tonight found out about it. They're like, wait, Tom Cruise is there? So they went down because they're trying to figure out, you know, we got to do something on the convention. So they tracked down Larry. Larry's like, no, this is not really him. It's a lookalike. And they were like, we're not going to do anything on it. We really thought it was him. And then it kept getting bigger and bigger. It was in the Times-Picayune and all of it. And finally they came back and they said, let us follow you guys for a night. So they followed us, and that made it even worse, because when you take an Entertainment Tonight camera and you tell people there's a Tom Cruise lookalike, they don't hear lookalike. They just hear Tom Cruise. And it blew up. I mean, we had a huge amount of people in the French Quarter, and we rented limos. That was one of our last nights there. And it was just a spectacle. So the story airs on Entertainment Tonight, and I end up getting 3 job offers like within a week after that. Bakersfield, Charleston, South Carolina, and Springfield, Missouri. And I ended up taking my first job in Springfield.
Wait, you didn't go to Bakersfield?
I did not go to Bakersfield.
I was a disc jockey for a year in Bakersfield.
Yeah. You know, but this is like, I have this story. I keep it on my Instagram because it's a reminder, like, this was before you had American Idol or Survivor and Richard Hatch and all these people who were getting famous for doing these reality shows. There was no way to really break through and get the exposure that this one story for ET did for me. And it was an opportunity. And then, of course, when that happens, you know, it's like if opportunity lands in your lap like that, you have got to step up and answer the call. So I really started working my butt off and worked in Springfield for a little bit. Then next thing I know, I get a call to come to LA. And ironically, and this goes back to, it's all about who you know. So Larry Perrette, who started that whole thing in New Orleans, was working at KCAL here in Los Angeles as one of the, he was the executive producer for, I think, the 8 o'clock show, and they needed a sports reporter. And he's like, I got somebody for you. So I flew out and then met with Beth Meharry, and then the rest is history.
You big sports guy? Are you a big sports fan?
Huge. I was a huge sports fan. As a kid growing up, I loved playing, you know, from baseball, football. Ran track in high school. I think we still hold the record now. We hold the record for the 4x100 yard relay. I think we might have it for the meter too. My brothers, I mean, the team, the school that I went to, they were state champions in football, runners up and then champions. My year, we didn't quite get there, but ended up playing at Northern Iowa, where Kurt Warner came from. There's a lot of big names that came out of that program. In fact, my roommate is still the head coach there. Carson Wentz played in our conference. There's been so many people that have come out of that Division I AA football that have gone on to do really, really well. One of my teammates is actually the head coach at K-State now. So I'm kind of off on a tangent here, but yeah, that's where I love sports. When I came here and I'm a Raider fan. So when the Raiders were here, you know, I would go into the press box, and that's when I learned the first time you have to sit on your hands because you can't cheer for the teams, you know, you're supposed to be impartial.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, come on. But it was nice, you know, I had my chance to date, you know, a couple Raiderettes, which was a big mistake. But, you know, probably
it's a mistake that most guys would be happy to make.
Right.
And I'm sure the Raiderettes are going, God, I'm going out with Tom Cruise. I always thought he was shorter, but.
Yeah. That's the, how you get it. You don't know. So many people ask, they're like, how do I get in? I want your job. And then a lot of times people will say stuff like, oh, I want to, you know, I want your job. And I go, what about, I just want to be on camera. And, you know,
doing what?
we go back a period of time where having a camera wasn't something you typically had. Now you have it, you know, here. Well, I say, if you want to be on camera, go get a camera at Best Buy and put yourself on camera. I said, that's not what the job is. The job is not being on camera. The job is being able to be a really good interviewer, to be, you know, sometimes just sit and listen to somebody, and knowing how to thread a very controversial or very fun. Robin Williams was always just so much fun to interview, but complicated because you can never keep him on point. And Madonna always, or Cher would always have fun. We'd always have fun and flirt with each other. And there was just, there's just so much, you know, I actually found more pleasure in interviewing celebrities than I did athletes.
Well, I understand that after having interviewed a number of athletes, like playing tennis against a blanket in some cases.
I haven't heard that one, but that's a good one. You know, it's
what are some tips for good interviewing?
I think that, you know, a couple little things you may, that it's like, if I'm talking with somebody who's just starting out, is just listen, and a follow up with a why. Why is always the best, you know. You can come, and it also, if you're not quite sure what you want to ask next, it always helps you buy time and be really curious, like, why? Why was that this, and why did you want to play this?
Larry King told me the exact same thing.
Yeah.
When I asked him that question, he told me the exact same thing.
Yeah. I think that's probably really key. The other part, working with celebrities, it's an interesting dilemma, because if there is, like, Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, when the split happened, I was in Monte Carlo. Oh no, Cannes Film Festival. And she was doing Moulin Rouge, and we were going to sit down for a 20-minute interview. And she the only thing she had done at that point about talking about their split was in, I don't know, it was Elle magazine or something, where you could tell she probably had last editorial rights over what was there, because it was very, very groomed. So that's the only information I had to work with in anticipation of how she may respond to certain questions. And I remember sitting waiting for her, and we had our little cabana set up, and they said 20 minutes, and then, oh, she's running late. Now you have 17 minutes. Okay, great. Waiting. They came in, they go, okay, she's here. It's 15 minutes. And I'm like, okay, you keep cutting time from me. They bring her in, they sit her down, they're putting the microphone on. And as they're doing it, the publicist leans into me and says, you have 10 minutes. And I'm like, I've got to get, first of all, Moulin Rouge was a huge, you know, departure for her. Mm-hmm. And I also had to get to the personal stuff. And if you front load an interview like that and you just talk about the Moulin Rouge stuff, as soon as you transition, she's just going to get up and leave, because you're either out of time, or, and she will talk it through to 10 minutes is up.
Yeah. She's gotten her bullet points out. She's done.
And she's done. She doesn't have to answer your other questions. So you can't. But yet, if you front load it, I had the same thing with Lisa Marie Presley. If you front load the interview with these really salacious questions, your chemistry is just going to fall apart. And so you just have to tiptoe through, and you're constantly reading their body language. I could tell. You know, she was nervous. She was not nervous. She was caution. There was a lot of caution and distance there. And, you know, there's not a lot of trust. So you have to build that up. And that goes across, I think, your entire career. If publicists who represent these different people, really, they're like, look, you can trust Mark. He's not going to go there. He won't do this. They can sit back and really relax, and they, like, John Travolta always knew that. We had some of the, and Cher, we always had the greatest conversations. And a lot of the stuff just never made air. But that to me is one of the tough parts of dealing. Today, we're not so much in that salacious society as we were back then. you know, plastic surgery gone bad kind of stuff, and rehabs and all of those things that were so part of our landscape, you know, a lot of that is sort of taboo now, which is good.
Yeah. I guess too, when actors go on these junkets, it's very rough for them because they're sitting in a room and over the course of 8 hours, 15 different people come in to interview them and ask the same questions, and they have to sound like, oh, that's the first time you asked me that. Yeah. No one's ever asked me, do I do my own stunts?
Yeah.
So you got to be aware of that too.
Yeah.
When you're the ninth reporter to come in and interview them.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's good to have a rapport. I'm proud of this. I was requested for many interviews, which meant people really wanted to, you know, Ricky Martin. I flew all over the world chasing Ricky Martin when after that Grammy appearance that he had, it was from that point forward. I mean, I remember being in Italy under the stage in the prayer circle, and he's standing like in the middle, and we're all huddled around him, and he's like, come here. And I walked with him, and he's like, here, and we're all doing the prayer circle. And then all of a sudden the platform just raises up, and he goes up to perform, and I'm left down there with the dancers. I'm like, okay. But, you know, you have these really cool moments, and they're so rare, and it becomes like any business. It's about relationships. It's what it comes down to, and trust.
Have you ever had an interviewee get pissed and just march off in the middle of the interview?
This didn't happen to me. But it did happen to our show. We did an interview, and I don't know the specifics of it, but, and bless her heart, with Anne Heche, in New York. She did the interview, and it was a pretty revealing, you know, it was post the Ellen time, but, she ended up taking, she got up and left the hotel room, and she came back in pretty quickly and wanted to see the tapes. And then she took the tapes and she went in the bathroom and she locked herself in the bathroom with her footage. That was, you know, there were some issues that were going on there, but I don't know if she just was like regretting what she'd done in the interview or whatever. My interaction with Anna Nicole Smith was pretty unique. I was the last one to interview her before she passed away. She didn't do anything that was, you know, bad in that regard, as far as like trying to sabotage. John Travolta got mad at me once. Not me, but we did an interview and he was doing Battlefield Earth, the movie. Mm-hmm. And that was Ron L. Hubbard. And our producers, unbeknownst to me, I was home, ran a story and sort of made it a point that this was a Scientology based Ron Hubbard thing, and he didn't like that at all, and he called me at home, and there were some words exchanged, and I said, I'll take care of it. And I called up and I said, do you think we could probably pull out the Scientology stuff, because John's a little upset about that? And we ended up doing that, because it's part of the sensational component of, I think, again, we went back to that element of it. Everything had to be some controversy around it, in order for it to sell, I guess. So, but those are all things above my pay grade when they happen.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, since you're the face, you're the one that, you know, bears the brunt of that.
Yeah.
So you were at ET for 17 years. You did a lot of hosting. Mm-hmm. There is a real art to learning the teleprompter.
Yes.
Not everybody can do it.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about it. It is. Because there are many times you're reading it cold. Like, they're changing things and they're like, you just read it. We got to go. We're going to hit the satellite, you know? And so you're reading it cold. You do have writers that when you're there that long, they know how to write in your voice. So you get that part of it. A component that was very challenging that a lot of people didn't quite get because you didn't see the big, big picture of it. But when we moved to Radford Lot, our stage had 110-inch plasmas on it. So there were two horizontal ones and one vertical, or two verticals maybe. And the stage was also, it was circular and then another tier on top of it. So, and two steps down and to a bigger platform. And that spun. And behind it was this site that you could change and put different pictures in it or whatever. So when you had to read teleprompter on that, they have it on a jib. So you had to start maybe at the top level. The platform would start to spin. You had to, while it's spinning, not looking down, because you're having to follow the jib, the swinging arm of the jib, which comes swinging around, and you're having to read that and walk down these steps. Nancy O'Dell, I remember, fell once, and they were like, okay, we're not going to do that anymore with her. Because she, you know, high heels trying to do that. I'm like, uh-huh. But it really was this sort of pat your tummy, rub your head at the same time kind of feel. That is where it can get a little challenging at times, to read the prompter and have all the other stuff going on. But I think like anything, you know, you just get used to it and you understand, you know, if I read too fast, I'm going to run into trouble because I'm going to start, you know, not breathing properly. And it takes a little bit of talent to do it, but yeah, I could teach a monkey, I think.
Well, they taught me when I was hosting movies on Turner Classic Movies. And for people who don't know, the teleprompter is on the front of the camera. So mm-hmm. you, as the anchor, are looking straight into the teleprompter. You're looking straight into the lens. And it's big enough. It was easy enough for me to read. But what they decided to do is they had the camera on a crane, and similar fashion, they were going to start with a big high shot, and the camera was going to slowly push in. But when the camera went to its first high position, the teleprompter is now a postage stamp.
Okay. I've had that too. Where we've actually had it where it's revealed from behind a monitor. So you have to memorize the first like three lines of it. And hopefully, you know, I had an amazing Joshua Mertz. He was such an amazing teleprompter operator. He was so good at like stopping, backing out, like if we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. And he knew, he was just so good because a couple things that you can, that if you're really trained, you can watch and you can see someone's pupils going back and forth, right? Uh-huh. So you want to watch that. So you sort of like are using this gestalt feeling where you're trying to read it all without having to read each individual word. There's also a point where you want to keep the line that you're reading at one spot in the teleprompter and not up and down. So you're doing one of these
right,
things.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And he was great at doing that. I mean, it is a skilled position to have. A lot of people don't understand that until you get a bad teleprompter operator who falls asleep at the wheel and you're like, hello, come on. Like you're waiting. He would go. And if sometimes, you know, sometimes you may ad lib a little bit. And he would pause and he would back up a little bit and wait for you to catch up. So those people really make the job so much easier.
Yeah, TCM, the woman who did it for me, had been Jimmy Carter's teleprompter person. Mm-hmm. She was great. Yeah. She was great, yeah. She really followed me and my pace. Yeah, she was terrific.
They now have, like, we used to, like, Hurricane Katrina, I was down in the Houston area for that and the Superdome area. We flew in and then drove.
Tom Cruise is back in New Orleans.
Right. Scene of the crime. Back then it was Blackberries, and they would text us an entire show, and we would have to, like, you know, either hold it up, have somebody hold it next to the lens, or you had to, like, memorize a certain part. And then, you know, this part I'll be off camera so I can read it. There's another time. This is something that I learned that I could do and didn't realize I could. It's one of those rare, like, freakish circus trick things you can do. So I was in London. I had to go to the Venice Film Festival, and they're sending me there, and they're like, oh, when you get there, you need to shoot the weekend show, the whole show. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, yeah, we need you to do the whole show there. Shoot all the stand-ups. We're going to have you in gondolas and all these other places. We have it all set up. The producer's going to meet you there. Now, our weekend show was an hour long, and there were a lot of, like, longer on-camera reads, and there was a lot to memorize, and we were chasing the sun. And I was like, man, how am I going to do this? So I had I didn't get the scripts till I got there. So when I was in at the UK airport at Heathrow, I ran in, I bought a tape player, and I had my earpiece. And what we did simply was I took the copy and I read it deliberate, slow into, not slow, but slow enough into the microphone. And then I put my earpiece in and we disguised it and we shot more from the side. And I would just push play and it would come in this ear and come out of the mouth. And that's, I would just have to, and you know, it's an audio prompter is what basically I'm getting to. And I didn't, it's one of those, some people can do and other people get really confused by it. So that saved the day for us in being able to knock out an entire show without a teleprompter and doing it while we're chasing the sun, because we only had one shot at it, and that's not fun to do. I also, another point in my career that goes back to sports is when the strike was happening with the Kings, or the Kings were, you know, playing here and Gretzky and all that. And they were doing really well. And Bruce McNall was going to come out and have a press conference. So I had just started too, by the way, working at KCAL. And they send me down and they're like, okay, we're going to get some updates. We'll see what's going on. But, you know, McNall will come out. So, you know, there it's like, you know, the Fox affiliates and everybody's there in, as well as the local stations, ESPN. And we're standing there. We're set to go live and it's just waiting and we're waiting. And finally, they're like, we're going to bring in some food and people were eating and the whole bit. And then they come to it's just before the 8 o'clock news, because KCAL had an 8, 9, 10 o'clock news. And Jeff Kaufman, my producer, comes in my ear and he's like, I remember this because there's so many people like just sitting around. And by then there, we were just in this, you know, room. There wasn't internet. There wasn't anything like that you could get. So he comes on in my ear and goes, the strike is over and you're going to tell everybody about this. And I'm like, wait, what? I'm in this conference and we're waiting for, how do you know this? And he goes, it just broke on the wire. Minnesota has their general manager just announced this. So I'm like, well, and we are like, I'm hearing the start of the newscast in my ear and I'm still not, I still have no information to confirmation on any of this. And very calmly, and this goes back to how when you have a great producer, he just goes, he pushes the little mic button. He goes, just repeat after me and look into the lens and talk to Jerry Dunphy. And I'm like, okay. And sure enough, it came out and they turned to me and they were like, okay, here, you know, and he was just reading the AP wire copy in my ear. And I had to spit it out. And as I was doing that, I could feel everybody in that room, all the other reporters looking at me going, what do you mean the strike is over? How do you know that? Like that information hasn't come out yet. And just as I was about finished, he then says, Bruce McNall just walked in behind you, turn and toss it to him. And sure enough, it was just flawless the way it happened.
Broadcast news.
It really was. And that was one of those times where I was like, wow, I pulled that out, you know. But you don't do that by yourself. You have to have a team that does it. And again, seeing all the other people in that room turn and look at me going, who's this new guy, first of all? And he looks like Tom Cruise. And second of all, like, how does he know this information? But that's sometimes how you do it, you know, by the seat of your pants. And you just go. And You know, you get, you even see Colbert sometimes do this. This just in, you know, jokingly, but that's exactly what had happened.
Now, before I let you go, I gotta say, you did something so cool. You had a surprise wedding. You had a bunch of people over for a barbecue, and then you announced that you were getting married in an hour.
Yeah. We had a celebration for a new season. We were renewed for a new season at Home and Family, and we're such a close group of people. And I met my wife, Julie, there on the show. So we thought, you know, and we knew immediately after we met that we were going to get married. So we waited for the year or whatnot. And then we talked about where do we want to do this? We were kind of planning a little bit, but just didn't, you know, my wife was very, she's sort of introverted. She's like, oh, let's just go to the beach or let's just do this. And I go, no, we're going to have a big deal. And so we made a surprise. You know, we had everybody come over and everybody that came was like, oh, this is a, you know, season 5 launch party or whatever. And we hosted it here at the house. And I think we had 250 people or whatever and had a band and all that. And yeah, we just had a pop-up wedding. And we had...
you didn't have a chopped liver swan because that would have given it away.
We had Dot Marie Jones came. She was the one who married us. She's been a friend for years. It was just so much fun. Like everybody just had a blast. It was a short ceremony. Julie's family came in and, you know, and it's been wedded bliss ever since.
That's great. Final question.
Yeah.
What's easier, being the interviewer or being the interviewee?
Oh, being the interviewer, 100 times easier, 100 times easier. I'm not, I mean, I can, you can see I can handle an interview, but I much prefer, you know, being the person questioning people because I just find that much more interesting. You know, I talk about myself and but. You know, I probably should have flipped this a little bit. And I tend to do that sometimes. And I try not to, because I know people are like, well, we wanted to interview you. And now you're asking us all the questions. I'm like, I know, but I want to know. I find being the interviewer much, much more appealing than anything else.
Yeah, you do have a certain amount of control. Well, you're welcome to interview me anytime other than during the Rose Parade, because I'm usually asleep for the first half of it. So
we're going to have to get you up. You know what? The good thing is you can watch it on reruns.
That's true, which is what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. But, you know, I've never actually been to the Rose Parade. One year, I got to do that. You got an extra seat up there.
You bet. You let me know. I actually had never been to the Rose Parade before. I watched it tons growing up as
sure,
a kid.
Sure, me too.
My first time ever at the parade was going in as a host. I mean, that's, I guess, says something.
I guess what scared me, especially early on when I was a kid, they didn't have as many bleachers set up. So you had to go the night before and camp out on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. For the entire night.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's January 1st. So it's 28 degrees. It's 33 degrees, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
My parents were like, not a chance. that we're going to do that.
You know, when you come from Iowa, like I have, if you're in January and it's, you know, 30 degrees, it's balmy.
Summer. Yeah. Know? No, I know. I know. I did get to go one year. I think I was like 9 years old. After the parade, the floats are on display at a park for a few days. So we went to see the floats. And here's the thing that struck me. And I know this ages me quite a bit, but it was so great to see the floats in color. Because back then, you know, you're watching the Rose Parade, it's all in black and white.
Yeah. Wow. You know? That's true.
And I think about that now as I sit and I'm looking at a big screen TV and it's high definition and the picture quality is just so phenomenal that we now just take for granted. And I think back to those days when I would like watch the parade on like little 19-inch black and white Sony Trinitron, and I'd be thrilled.
But think of this, though. Back in 1890, when the Valley Hunt Club said that the whole idea was, you know, these were people from the East and Midwest who moved out here when, oh, my God, this is beautiful. Look at everything's in bloom. Let's show the world, you know, what this Chamber of Commerce day looks like for us. But they had to do it in black and white. Right. Like, yeah. So it didn't it still reverberated with people. They still resonated with people where they're like, oh, my gosh, look at those flowers. They're black and white and some gray, you know. But when you're right, when the color comes around and you begin to see now with the high definition, it's even more spectacular to see. So it's it is nice to sit back at home and watch now these days. You see some of the old footage that you pull up on YouTube and you're like, wow, did they just put Vaseline on the lens? Like, what is that? God.
When you're watching other parades, do you critique the hosts? Do you go, oh, Jesus Christ, shut up?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I watch it just because I want to see what the feeling is like. Like there's a whole separate feel for the Macy's. Like there's some performances that are nice, but when you look at like, oh, they just put some, and I don't, this is not bashing Macy's at all. But when I see the work that goes into a float versus blowing up a balloon, you know, and floating it down I'm like, I still prefer like.
You need good lung capacity though.
Yeah. A lot of hot air.
To blow those up. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Mark, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's always fun to talk about the things that we do, you know?
Absolutely. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care.
Our thanks to Mark Steines, and that will do it for this week on Hollywood and Levine. As always, our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, should you wish to get in touch, is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I am on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. And like every podcast, I could use a 5-star review. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you again next week right here on
Hollywood and Levine.